All right, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 231. It's October 1st. And maybe I'll turn up the microphone a little bit. Hold your ears. Maybe it's going to start the feedback. Can you hear me yet? Sort of? Not really. Okay, it's better. Very good. Ooh, that's a little too loud now. Okay, let's turn some of these lights off. Like that. Having a little bit of trouble with the projectors today, but I think if I collapse the screen a little bit, you can see all the information. And I don't want to mess with it to pull up the syllabus, but there are no lecture exams this week or practicums this week, but there are lab quizzes, and of course there's online quiz on Friday. Right? Does anybody have a question about the schedule at all? Since I have the slide set up in a useful mode, I'd like to just start lecture, I think, instead of showing you the schedule on the syllabus. All right, so last time we talked about the appendicular skeleton, and as a matter of fact, that's what you look at in lab this week. We went over all the bones of the appendicular skeleton, including the hands and the feet, and we're ready to move on to joints now. And another name for a joint is articulation. All right, so let's see. Did I tell you the date? October 1st, 231, chapter 9. Okay, we have to classify joints by a couple of different methods. They can either be classified by their structure or by their function. And sometimes by their structure, we know what their function is, so sometimes this classification scheme is a little redundant. But nonetheless, when we say articulation, you should know that that is a joint, and some joints allow for motion between bones, and other joints between neighboring bones don't allow for motion. So let's look at the structural classification of joints first. It's based on material that binds the bones together, right? And these joints can be classified as fibrous joints if they have what between the two bones? Fibers between the two bones, right? They could be cartilaginous if they have what between the two bones? Cartilage, yeah. And they can be synovial. And synovial you're not familiar with yet. Okay, it's a special kind of joint that has a number of different kinds of pieces involved in making a synovial joint, and we're going to look at that today. All right, so it's not just a simple fiber, it's not just simple cartilage, but it has a bunch of stuff. So that's the structural classification. The functional classification, this is the second way that we can classify joint, focuses on the amount of movement that's allowed between the two bones. And a synarthrosis is immovable. A synarthrosis is immovable. Amphiarthrosis is slightly movable. And a diarthrosis is freely movable. So if I look at the first three the first letter of each of these three terms right here, that spells out another word. What does synarthrosis, amphiarthrosis, and diarthrosis spell out if you just were to take the first letter and make an acronym up? SAD. Okay, so that's pretty easy to remember. SAD, and that's on the order of mobility in a functional classification scheme of joints. So synarthrosis is what? Immovable, amphiarthrosis is slightly movable, and diarthrosis is freely movable. Okay, here's a sign-in sheet for today. Let's start passing that around. Okay, so we got two classification schemes, structural and functional. With structure, we have fibrous, cartilaginous, and synovial. And for functional, we have immovable, slightly movable, and freely movable. And I gave you some examples. Let's look at fibrous joints. And what type of joint, what kind of classification is a fibrous joint? Fibrous joint is a structural classification, so some might be movable, some might be immovable, some might be slightly movable, all depends on the particular kind of joint. All right, so fibrous joints are connected by dense regular connective tissue and lack a joint cavity. There's no cavity between these two bones. We got three different kinds. We got sutures, syndesmoses, and gomphoses. And the slide on the right shows a picture of these different kinds of joints. Here is a suture between cranial bones that make up the cranium and This is typically what we call an immovable joint. It's a fibrous joint. And a syndesmosis is a fibrous joint as well. Joints are held together by a ligament, for instance, like this distal talofibular joint. So here is a ligament that holds the fibula up against the tibia. It helps make this notch that the talus can move into. That's a syndesmosis. And then a gomphosis, again, is a fibrous joint because it just has fibers. Here is an alveolus, and here is the root of a tooth inserted into the alveolus, and that would be in the maxilla or mandible. And I see the ligament between the root of the tooth and the alveolar process. And this is what we call the periodontal ligament, right in this location. That's what holds your tooth in either the mandible or maxilla. Sometimes you might bite into some food, for instance, like maybe a hot dog or something like that, that has a little piece of bone in it, and it tweaks this tooth, and you feel a sharp little pain, and that's because you've stretched this periodontal ligament out just instantaneously when you bit into something that has a little hard piece in it when you thought maybe it shouldn't have any hard pieces in it. All right, so these right here are what we call fibrous joints, because what makes up these joints, all these different joints? Ligaments, yeah, fibers. Here's the periodontal ligament, here's just a regular ligament, and then there's dense connective tissue, dense regular connective tissue in these sutures as well. All right, let's talk of another kind, a structural classification, and that is cartilaginous joints. All right, cartilaginous joints, bones are united by cartilage in cartilaginous joints, and there again, there's no joint cavity. There's no joint cavity between the bones. A synchondrosis, united by hyaline cartilage, and it's immovable. So immovable is a synarthrosis. Remember in SAD, the first letter S in SAD is immovable. Then you got amphiarthrosis and diarthrosis. What kind of joint is a diarthrosis? Freely movable, right. So the synarthrosis is an immovable joint, right? And the epiphyseal plates are discs, and the first manubrial costal joint is a synchondrosis. We can see that on the slide on the right. So here is an immovable joint. This is the growth plate in a pre-adolescent individual. And then here is the costal cartilage for rib number one. All right, this is an immovable joint. So rib number one is very stationary. It doesn't move, kind of acts as an anchor for the rest of the rib cage. All right, so these are synchondroses because they are made out of cartilage. Okay, another kind of cartilaginous joint is a symphysis. And a symphysis does not have hyaline cartilage, but has fibrocartilage. And these joints are slightly movable. What was the classification for slightly movable? So you should think of SAD. Slightly movable would be the A, right? That would be the amphiarthrosis, slightly movable. Good examples of that would be the intervertebral discs between vertebral bodies and the pubic symphysis. These are fibrocartilage discs. And you can rotate the vertebral body slightly, but not too much, because that could herniate a disc. And the pubic symphysis, okay, is also slightly movable. It's more movable at certain times. When would the pubic symphysis be the most movable in somebody's life? Like during parturition, right? During parturition, which guys can't experience. Okay. Another kind of joint, right, another kind of structural classification. Well, what were they? You got fibrous, cartilaginous, and then the third kind is what? A synovial joint. It's a type of structural classification. All of these joints right here are diarthroses. What the heck is a diarthrosis? Freely movable joint. Okay, so don't forget about those two classification schemes. So the slide on the right shows a nice diarthrosis. And it's a synovial joint. So let's analyze this slide right here. So I see two long bones. So here is the distal epiphysis of one long bone meeting up with the proximal epiphysis of another long bone. I can see these lines right here. And let's just say if this was an adult, that would be, what would we call this area that's really light? That would be the epiphyseal line, but if it's a pre-adolescent individual, this would be called the epiphyseal plate or growth plate. I can see nice spongy bone, cortical bone over here. Okay, now let's focus our attention where these two bones approximate each other, where they come close together. That's what we're going to call an articulation or a joint. Covering the epiphyses of both of these bones is articular cartilage. And articular cartilage is just another name for hyaline cartilage. And you could probably have a picture in your mind of what that looks like histologically. You're underneath a microscope. You don't see any fibers. It just kind of looks translucent, though you do see some chondrocytes and lacunae in this area right here. But I've never seen any blood vessels in hyaline cartilage, and indeed there are no blood vessels. Right? And so that covers the condylar surfaces of both the distal epiphysis and the proximal epiphysis of these bones that are forming this joint. Then we have a cavity. So this is the cavity that we were talking about, which is absent in a fibrous joint and cartilaginous joint, but we see it in a synovial joint. And this cavity, which we call the synovial cavity or joint cavity, contains synovial fluid. And that synovial fluid brings nutrients and oxygen to those chondrocytes that inhabit the hyaline cartilage. And it also takes away some waste products. That synovial fluid is secreted into the joint cavity by the synovial membrane. So here is synovial membrane. It's kind of continuous with the hyaline cartilage. And so it nourishes and lubricates the hyaline cartilage so that these bones can move and slip and slide up against each other without grinding each other away. All right, then on the outside of the synovial membrane is the fibrous capsule. Because the synovial membrane is a very delicate kind of structure, the fibrous capsule is stronger, maintains the integrity of the joint. And if we put the fibrous capsule together with the synovial membrane, we get a structure that we call the articular capsule right here. So the synovial membrane helps maintain the health of the hyaline cartilage or articular cartilage. And then spanning joints, of course, there could be muscles with tendons, but there are also ligaments. So here's a ligament that goes from the proximal bone to the distal bone across the joint. And a ligament, remember, is a bone-to-bone connection. And what kind of tissue is this ligament right here? Anybody remember what kind of tissue a ligament is? It's dense, regular CT, right? So all the collagen fibers are lined up in parallel arrays or sheets. So this ligament can withstand a lot of tension from end to end, but not from side to side within the middle of a ligament. That's why it's important to properly use joints in the way that they have been designed to work. Okay, and the articular capsule and tendons and ligaments are continuous with the membrane that surrounds the bone. What do we call that membrane that surrounds the bone? The periosteum, right? And don't forget, there's also a membrane that lines every internal cavity inside of a bone. What do we call that membrane? The endosteum, right? All right, so this is an exam figure, so make sure you can label all the pieces of this joint. And it's a, what kind of joint is this? It's a synovial joint, okay, by structural classification. And because it's a synovial joint, all synovial joints are what kind of motion? Freely movable, and a freely movable joint by a functional classification is what we call a diarthrosis. Right? So we got synarthrosis, amphiarthrosis, and diarthrosis. And a synovial joint are all diarthrosis. All right, so here are some things that make up a synovial joint. There's some things that I didn't talk about. Okay, we talked about a ligament right here. Let's talk about some other things that could make up a joint. All right, so here is a shoulder joint. And so here is the head of the humerus. Here is the scapula, and here is that concave part of the scapula. That's a fossa that accepts the head of the humerus. So this is the glenoid cavity or glenoid fossa. And it has hyaline cartilage. The head of the humerus has hyaline cartilage that we can see right in this region right here. And then I see a joint cavity filled with synovial fluid. So what kind of joint is a shoulder joint? It's a synovial joint, all right? And by function, what kind of joint is it? It's a diarthrosis or freely movable joint. Yes, because it's a synovial joint. All right, so I can see also in this joint some bursae. So here is the subacromial bursae, and I can see it right here and right here. And a bursa is like a pillow that acts like another synovial cavity within the synovial cavity. So there is a synovial membrane with synovial fluid on the inside, and it's completely continuous, and it acts as a buffer between the head of the humerus, right, and the coracoacromial ligament. Or it could act as a buffer between two bones that come very close together, or between a muscle and a bone that come very close together. So it just aids in the motion of this joint, and it reduces friction between some of these static structures like ligaments and the articular surface of a bone that's moving very, very close to this ligament right here. So think of a bursa as like being an additional joint capsule that can move around very nicely and easily and slippery and allow for motion of articulations. All right, so here I see the subacromial bursa. Then we have something called a tendon sheath. So here is the head of the humerus. Here is the tendon of the long heads of the biceps brachii, which is a big strong muscle in your anterior arm. And we can see this tendon going between the greater and lesser tubercles in the humerus. What do we call that space between the greater and lesser tubercles on the humerus? Intertubercular groove or intertubercular sulcus. You're going to see that this week. Maybe we talked about it in lecture last week, but in lab you're going to see it this week. So here's the tendon of the biceps brachii going over the head of the humerus. So this will put a lot of tension on the head of the humerus and cause an inflammation and irritation. And so surrounding this tendon is another bursa, okay? But this bursa, since it's around a tendon, we call it a tendon sheath, right? And it allows for a nice slippery motion of this tendon and allows for the working of the biceps brachii without producing a lot of friction and irritation of the tendon itself and the head of the humerus. Of course, you can't overdo it. You can't overwork these joints, and you can irritate a bursa in a joint and it becomes inflamed, just like you can actually inflame the synovial cavity of a joint. When you inflame the synovial cavity, then the synovial membrane that I see right here becomes very leaky and secretes a lot of fluid into the synovial cavity, and that inhibits the motion, produces irritation and pain and irritation of the joint. The same thing can happen with these bursa, right? If they're overused or inappropriately used, they can become inflamed and enlarged. And when that happens, that causes a very painful condition. Does anybody know what that painful condition is when a bursa becomes irritated and inflamed? That's bursitis. That's right. Whenever you use this particular limb, then this object right here is going to remind you that that joint is damaged. And then there's different ways of treating it, okay, just by not exercising the joint, but it's severe, then you'd probably need some kind of, well, I guess probably some non-steroidal anti-inflammatories as a systemic, but if that doesn't work, then even a cortisone injection into that particular joint. Same thing for this tendon sheath. Okay, notice that the tendon of the biceps brachii goes right through the joint capsule of the shoulder, right? Because here you can see the fibrous capsule right here. And that's why it has a tendon sheath around it. Okay, there's some cartilage on the lip or the rim of the glenoid cavity. Here's the glenoid cavity in the scapula. Here is some fibrocartilage. And this is what we call the labrum of the shoulder joint. It just makes the glenoid cavity a little bit deeper, and it stabilizes the shoulder joint. All right, but this fibrocartilage, or this labrum, is it as strong as bone? Is cartilage as strong as bone, do you think? It's lighter, okay? It's avascular. It's not as strong as bone, so it's easy to damage the labrum of the shoulder by inappropriate use of a shoulder joint. Maybe throwing a baseball too fast or too much spin or catching a football with a weird angle on your shoulder can, and ladies can't relate to what I'm talking about. Okay. But anyway, this, so here is the glenoid labrum, which deepens the fossa for accepting the head of the humerus right here. Okay. So the glenoid cavity is pretty shallow. That means that you have a lot of dexterity of the shoulder joint. You have a lot of mobility, a lot of degrees of freedom. But that also means the trade-off is that the shoulder is a relatively weak joint as a result of that. Okay. Unlike the hip joint that we're going to take a look at in just a little bit, right? The cavity that the femur sits in is called the acetabulum, and it's a very deep cavity. So the hip joint is a very strong joint compared to the shoulder, but what's the trade-off for the hip? It's a stronger joint, but you can't move it as much, right? It's less movable or more immovable, but it's stronger because it has to support more body weight. And the hip joint does not have a labrum, only the shoulder joint here. Okay, so we've got bursas, tendon sheaths. Let's see what joints we're going to do. We've got another page right here. Let's look at another joint. Let me see if I can find another joint. Okay, I might flip through some of these slides pretty quickly. Hold on, I'll tell you when you can look back at the projector. Okay, oh, I tell you what, before I pass this slide by, okay, here you can see the glenoid labrum, which is that fibrocartilage that is lining the glenoid cavity. Here you can see the acromion process, the coracoid process on the scapula, right? And all of these tendons and ligaments that make up the fibrous capsule of the shoulder. But the joint that I want you to know the most about is the knee joint. So I'm trying to get to a knee. Oh, here is, since we're here, here is the head of the femur. Here is the acetabulum, and you can see how deep the acetabulum is. The head of the femur inserts into the acetabulum, plus the femur has this ligament. It's called the ligamentum teres, and there is a blood vessel that goes through the ligamentum teres into the head of the femur, okay, that nourishes the head of the femur. Because what kind of tissue is bone? Is it a living tissue or a dead tissue? It's a living tissue. So there are what kind of cells in this area here? Osteocytes, yeah, there's osteocytes in this area, and that blood nourishes those cells, and if this blood supply is interrupted or damaged, then guess what happens to those cells? They die. And the head of the femur then dissolves away, and you're left with a jagged bone right here. All right, so any kind of hip trauma can damage this blood vessel, and I think in lecture, maybe last time I did mention this, there was a professional athlete who played both professional football and baseball, and he got tackled really, really hard, and this blood vessel was damaged so that his hip was basically destroyed. And he was such a phenomenal athlete that even after replacing this hip joint with a prosthesis, he was able to go back and play professional baseball. Who was that? That was Bo Jackson. Yeah, we mentioned him last time. He never went back to play football again, which is probably wise. Right, but he's amazing. So even with artificial joints, people can still perform at like a maximum performance level. That's pretty nice. Okay, knee joint. Look at the knee. Here is a knee, and I want to start with, let's start with this picture. Okay, so here is the knee. Here is the patella. All right, so the femur is up in this region. We can't see it because it's deep to these muscles in the anterior thigh. And these muscles are what we call the quadriceps muscles. This is going to be the medialis. Here's the rectus femoris. And here is the lateralis. And I know which one is lateral and medial because I can look at the tibia and fibula. And somebody told me one way that you could remember which bone is lateral in your leg, because here's a nice L in fibula, and where else do you have an L? In lateral. Okay, so you should always remember fibula is lateral and the tibia is medial, because down at the distal epiphyses of these two bones, there's a malleolus, right? There's a lateral malleolus and a medial malleolus. And where would you find, what bone would the lateral malleolus be located on? The fibula. And the medial malleolus is on the tibia. It's not shown on this diagram because you have to go all the way down to the distal epiphysis. We only see the proximal epiphysis right here. Okay, so I see the patella, and I see the condylar processes on the femur, like the lateral condyle and medial condyle is over here. Here is the condylar surfaces on the tibia. So here's the lateral condyle on the tibia, the medial condyle of the tibia, and then here is the fibula. All right, so these muscles, the quadriceps muscles, pull on some dense regular connective tissue that we call the tendon of the quadriceps, because there are actually four muscles in this group. We can see three of them, but there are four that pull on this tendon, which inserts into the patella. And then there is a ligament that goes from the patella to the tibial tuberosity. So when the quadriceps contracts, that causes extension across the knee or a kicking motion, right? Because it's going to move this tibial tuberosity superiorly or anteriorly to produce extension of the leg. Okay, so I do want you to know the tendon of the quadriceps, because that's what attaches to the quadriceps muscle, and the patellar ligament, which is the connection between the patella and the tibial tuberosity. Now, can anybody tell me what kind of bone is the patella? It's kind of a strange bone because it's within this dense regular connective tissue. What do we call a bone that's embedded in a tendon or a ligament? It's called a sesamoid bone. Right, so the patella is a sesamoid bone. So don't forget the superior part is a tendon, the inferior part is a ligament, patellar ligament. I also see some other ligaments on the knee. We're not going to know all of these, but there are two more on this view that I want you to know. It is a ligament that goes from the lateral epicondyle of the femur down to the head of the fibula, and that's called the collateral ligament. So this is a lateral ligament. Sometimes it's called a lateral collateral ligament or the fibular collateral ligament, because the fibula is which bone in the leg? It's the lateral bone. Okay, and then on the other side, we have some nice symmetry. Here is the tibial collateral ligament. Probably you all have heard of a collateral ligament before because they get damaged all the time in athletes. All right, so you could call the tibial collateral ligament which one? The medial collateral ligament. So you got a medial collateral ligament or lateral collateral ligament, and I don't really care which one you call it. All right, but you know that these are kind of lined up in a nice coronal plane across the knee. All right, so what do you got to know so far? Well, you got to know the femur, the patella, the tibia, and fibula, right? And the joint surfaces are what we call condyles. So here's a lateral condyle on the tibia. Here's the medial condyle. And then on the femur, you have the lateral condyle on the femur and the medial condyle on the femur. You got to know the tendon of the quadriceps, the patellar ligament, and then the lateral and medial collateral ligaments so far on this slide. You only got to know a couple other things about the knee. That diagram is too complicated. But here is a nice exam figure, which shows pretty much everything except for the quadriceps muscle. Okay, so the muscle has been cut from the tendon, and then the tendon has been reflected down inferiorly so that we can actually look inside the knee. And then the femur has been bent posteriorly so that you can actually see the condylar surfaces inside the knee. All right, so what do we see from that previous slide? Here is the lateral collateral ligament. Here is the medial collateral ligament. What's another name for medial collateral ligament? Yeah, the tibial collateral ligament. And another name for the lateral collateral ligament is the fibular collateral ligament, because the fibula is lateral. Okay, here's the fibula. Okay, nice condylar surface, which is covered with hyaline cartilage. That's what gives it that nice blue kind of color in this artist's rendition, right? And notice that the articular surface of the patella is also covered with hyaline cartilage, and it's going to articulate with the patellar surface right here on the femur, right? So that's the articular surface on the femur. Between the condyles, we have the intercondylar notch within the femur. And just posterior to that, there are some insertions of two other ligaments that we're very interested in. And these ligaments cross over each other. Right, kind of like my two index fingers are crossing over each other. So these we don't want to call collateral ligaments. We want to call these ligaments that cross over each other, which is another name for cruciate. Right, so cruciate ligaments cross over each other. So here is the posterior cruciate ligament because it's posterior in the knee. This one that comes anterior is the anterior cruciate ligament. So there are two cruciate ligaments, two collateral ligaments within the knee for stabilizing the knee. Now the knee is a special joint because there is some extra fibrocartilage that we call menisci that help match up the condylar surfaces of the femur and the tibia. Notice that the fibula does not articulate with the femur, only the tibia does. That's why the tibia is a much bigger, stronger bone compared to the fibula. All right, so here is a meniscus. They're shaped like a letter of the alphabet, which is a C. So these are C-shaped cartilages within the knee, and they mirror each other. You don't have C and C, but you have like a C and then a backward C right here. All right, so you have matching up with the lateral condyle, the lateral meniscus, and then matching up with the medial condyle is the medial meniscus. You have two menisci within the knee. And medially located right off the tibia right here, the meniscus is very thin. And then when we move more medially or laterally within the leg, then the meniscus gets thicker. All right, so you can see that the tips of this meniscus, since it's thinner, is much more easily damaged than, say, the rim out over here. So when somebody tears a meniscus, it's usually off of the tip, right here, or this inner edge, which is really thin compared to the outer edge. All right, and then the fibrocartilage can move around inside the joint, and you can see it's kind of wedge-shaped, and it can actually wedge inside the knee and prevent the knee from moving when that happens. Okay, so when somebody has a torn meniscus, right, especially if it's floating around, then that part of the meniscus has to be removed to get the joint function back once again. It used to be that when somebody had a torn meniscus, they would go in and remove the whole meniscus. All right, and what would happen to somebody's knee as a result of that? Okay, well, that meniscus is there to stabilize the knee, so their knee became very unstable. But then also the hyaline cartilage on the condylar surface of the femur would rub up against, in a very kind of violent way, against the hyaline cartilage of the tibia, and it would get worn down so that you would have bone-to-bone contact within the knee once the meniscus is totally removed. And so now, of course, a good diagnosis is performed to find out using MRIs and maybe some orthoscopes to diagnose what the condition of the meniscus is so that only the smallest amount of the meniscus is removed and the maximum amount of meniscus is preserved to maintain the health of the joint through the life of the person that has that knee. Okay, so it's not a good idea to remove the whole meniscus, if at all possible. Okay, so here are the cruciate ligaments. The cruciate ligaments attach to a process between the condyles on the tibia that we call the intercondylar eminence of the tibia. You'll see that this week in lab. All right, let me see what the next slide looks like. Okay. I'm trying to see if I have a nice picture of the intercondylar eminence. Well, I can't really see it too much. So here is anterior. Here's the tibial tuberosity. Okay, and we have the lateral meniscus, medial meniscus, and this is the intercondylar eminence, which is actually poking up above the plane of the picture right here. Okay, so I think we went over joint motion. Did we go over joint motions? For instance, when I bend my elbow like this, did we learn what that's called? Or do we do that in this chapter? We do it in this chapter. Okay. let's talk about these joint motions, and then I'm going to come back. Oh, yeah, here it is. Then I'm going to come back to the knee to talk about what the function of these different ligaments and the tendon are for. Okay, so let's talk about some motions. All right, so I got to go back a bunch of slides. Okay, sorry, I can't get to it because I can't find the window, so I'm going to just flip back and forth. Okay, sorry about that. All right, so we're talking about the humerus. Okay, gliding motion. When bone crosses another, just slips over the other, for instance, like in the carpals, bones of the wrist. Okay, you can move your wrist back and forth. That's a gliding motion, because these bones are fairly flat, and so they can glide over each other. And they're synovial joints. And again, what's a functional classification of a synovial joint? It's a diarthrosis, it's freely movable, so your wrist is freely movable. Okay, then we have some angular motions. Okay, so if we put a dot right here and move it across our neck from left to right, we can move our head forward like this. That's what we call flexion. We can also move our head back. That's what we call extension. Okay, and if we move our head from a flexed position, and we're flexing the cervical spine right here, if we move our head to where it sits right on top of the vertebral column, that's extension. And if we move it back even further, we call that hyperextension. Some joints you can hyperextend, other joints you cannot. All depends on the shape of the joint. Okay, so the definition of flexion is when you decrease the angle between two bones, like between the mandible and the sternum. When you're decreasing that angle, we call that flexion. And then when you increase that angle, we call that extension. And then when you go further behind midline, then we can call that hyperextension. So this is extension of the neck. You can also extend and flex your vertebral column in the thoracic and lumbar region as well. Okay, so here is flexion of the lumbar, here is extension, and of course you can lean way back like that, and that's what we call hyperextension of the vertebral column. Remember, flexion is decreasing the angle between two bones. All right, so you got flexion, bending forward, extension, bending backwards. These are antagonistic motions. Flexion is the opposite motion compared to extension. And you have different sets of muscles that control flexion compared to those muscles that control extension. And let's talk about flexion and extension of your upper appendage. And let's consider the elbow joint right here. All right, so you got a humerus, got a radius and ulna in the forearm, and I can contract the muscle of the biceps. And guess what happens to the angle between my forearm and arm when my biceps contracts? It decreases. When it's decreasing, we call that flexion. Okay, that's controlled by the biceps. The biceps is antagonistic to the triceps, which is in the posterior arm. Biceps is the anterior arm. So when the triceps contracts, guess what happens? The antagonistic motion for what we talked about. So the antagonistic motion to flexion is extension. All right, so antagonism. What's your understanding of antagonism? Do you like to be around people that are antagonistic to you? Absolutely not. It's no fun, right? Okay. But in terms of a control system, ways that you control your body, antagonistic control systems are very important because it provides for precise control and balance. Antagonism is very important. We talked about the biceps and triceps. They're antagonistic to each other. But because they're antagonistic to each other, you have precise control and balance of where your hand is and where your fingertip was. Maybe last Friday night, okay, you were driving home, and a guy with a fancy blue or lady with a fancy blue uniform and the badge and sidearm pulled you over to the side of the road and said, put your fingertip on the tip of your nose like that. And hopefully you could do that, because that could demonstrate that you weren't intoxicated. And then furthermore, you could have described to the officer that you have nice, precise, antagonistic control of your fingertip because of the biceps and the triceps, right? Producing flexion and extension because you're an anatomy student. I'm sure they would have been really interested in hearing all of that. So antagonism in terms of physiology and anatomy is very important. It provides precise control and balance of your skeletal system. Right? It also is important for the endocrine system and for the nervous system as well, which we'll look at in this class later on and in the physiology classes. Right? So flexion and extension are antagonistic. They're operated by antagonistic muscles on opposite sides of the body. So for instance, when you flex your lumbar region, right, you are exercising stomach muscles. So the stomach muscles are going to contract. But when you extend, then it is the back muscles that contract and the abdominal muscles relax, right? So it's always an action between opposite body compartments to produce these and balance out antagonistic motions. All right, so another example of antagonism as being very important and not a, it doesn't have a bad connotation, but for instance, in your automobile, what are the two antagonistic motions or two antagonistic mechanisms that you have to have in your automobile, then you would never think of driving without them? The brake pedal and the gas pedal, right? Has anybody ever driven a car with only a gas pedal? It's fun at first, but it doesn't get real fun. It gets really scary fast. Okay, when that happens. It happened to me a couple times. Okay, and so that's really important because if you only have a gas pedal, okay, and you drive home, what happens when you get home after work? If you don't have a brake pedal, well, then you just have to wave goodbye because you can't stop, right? So antagonistic motion or control mechanisms are very important for precise control and balance. Okay, so here are some other examples of flexion and extension. Let's look at some other examples of flexion and extension. You can flex and extend your fingers, right? So this is flexion, this is extension, and maybe you can hyperextend the fingers a little bit. Elbow, you can flex, you can extend. What about hyperextend? No, you don't want to hyperextend your elbow. Your knee, you can flex and extend. What about hyperextend your knee? No, can't hyperextend. Okay? And in terms of the hip, you can flex and extend the hip as well. Remember, flexion is decreasing the angle between a couple body regions. So this is flexion at the hip, and here is extension. And what about the hip as far as hyperextension? Sure, you can hyperextend at the hip. That's no problem. All right, so remember. All right, so here is flexion at the knee. Here is what at the hip? That was flexion at the hip, and this is extension. This is, you got to see this, because we're going to go to another joint, which is really hard to see. All right, so here is, what did I just do? Extend, and here is flexion. Okay, we're going to look at the shoulder. And you can tell this is flexion because the angle is decreasing between my thigh and my trunk, okay? The shoulder, you can flex and extend as well, all right? So this is flexion at the shoulder. I don't see an angle decreasing between a couple bones. And here is extension at the shoulder. So how is it that you should be able to remember that pretty easily? Always think of the hip. Move them together. So what was this? Flexion at the hip. So this is flexion, and this is extension, and this is hyperextension. All right, so that's hard to see at the shoulder joint, but just think of the hip and move those body parts together the same way. So here is flexion, okay, extension, and then hyperextension. Here's flexion and extension at the knee. We talked about that one. Okay, because we're going to know some different muscles that produce these different kinds of motions. Okay, two other antagonistic motions, abduction and adduction. They're antagonistic to each other. So think of your digits that are on your hand. You can separate your fingers like this. We call that abduction when you're moving body parts farther from each other. Or you can add these fingers together like this. We call that adduction. So abduction, adduction. You can do that with your shoulder joint as well. You can. Okay, so we call that flexion and extension. But with the shoulder, you can move it away from your body line. That's what we call abduction, or you can bring your arms down to your side, that is adduction, right? So abduction, adduction. You can do the same with your legs and toes, okay? Moving toward or farther away from midline. They're antagonists. Circumduction is a combination of flexion and extension, abduction and adduction, with certain joints that are ball and socket joints. And the two joints that are ball and socket joints are the shoulder joint and the hip joint. And circumduction is a combination flexion, extension, abduction, and adduction. It's a windmill motion. So you can't do that with many kinds of joints in your body, but you can with the shoulder and the hip. Circumduction. Okay, rotation around one axis. For instance, you can turn your head to the right, you can turn your head to the left. And what bones allow for that kind of motion in your cervical spine? Only special bones. What are those two bones? Between the axis and the atlas. Not between the atlas and occipital bone, because then C1 is going to break if that happens, right? So left lateral rotation, right lateral rotation between C1 and C2. That's a rotation. You can also rotate the humerus within the shoulder joint. So I'm going to flex at the elbow. You believe that's flexion that I just did? Yeah, because I decreased the angle, right? And I can move my hand toward my belly button. That's rotating my humerus, right? And so that's a medial rotation. Here is a lateral rotation. I can only laterally rotate so far. Most people can't really laterally rotate too much. All right, so that is the humerus that is rotating. You can do the same thing with your femur, but not quite to the same degree. Lateral and medial rotation. Okay, what are some other ones? The mandible right here. Mandible, we mentioned in lab, is a pretty complicated joint. It can do all kinds of different things. For instance, you can open your mouth. We call that depression of the mandible. Right? We can also put our teeth together from the maxilla and mandibular teeth. We call that elevation when you close your mouth. So you can elevate or depress the mandible. Okay? You can also retract. You can pull your jaw in or you could jut it out. Don't break a tooth. Right? So protraction is pushing it forward. Retraction is pulling it backwards. And as a matter of fact, you can do that with the shoulder as well. Protraction is moving your shoulder anteriorly. Retraction is putting your shoulders back. And you can also elevate the shoulders. You can depress the shoulders. All those kinds of motions. All right, here is one that's maybe a little bit complicated, and that is supination and pronation. And it has to do with a motion at the elbow joint. Mostly the elbow is a hinge joint for flexion and extension. But in anatomic position, which way are your thumbs pointing? Laterally. Okay, so the palms of your hands are facing anteriorly. While in anatomic position, you can move some muscles that work at the elbow so that the palms of the hand face posteriorly, like this. All right, so the joint in the wrist isn't moving. It's really a joint in the elbow that's moving. Right, so the palms can face posteriorly. We call that pronation, when all the P's kind of line up. Pronation is palms posterior. Supination is when the palms are facing anteriorly like this. Right, and so some people say supination because if you put your hands together with your palms anterior, forms a soup bowl. So that would be an easy way to remember that one. Right, so supination, pronation. Sort of like a rotation. And what you notice on this illustration right here is when you are pronated, the ulna and radius cross over each other. And when you're supinated, the radius and ulna are parallel to each other. They don't cross over. And that's probably the big reason why in anatomic position you are, what, supinated or pronated? Supinated, right? Because the bones are just nice and parallel. The nerves don't cross over. The muscles don't cross over. The bones don't cross over. It's a nice, simple anatomical structure to appreciate. All right, so those are some motions. You have a special joint, okay, in the thumb that allows for opposition. So opposition is moving your thumb a little bit anteriorly and then pressing up against your fingers. So that's the only joint in our body that can perform opposition for grasping. At the ankle, if here is the axis of rotation, right, so here is the great toe, and the great toe is what, medial or lateral? Okay, medial, yeah, your little toe is lateral, unlike your thumb, right, in your upper appendage. And so, the big toe is medial, so here is the tibia, here is the fibula, and then here's the malleolus of those two bones, so here is the lateral malleolus on the fibula, here's the medial malleolus on the tibia, so that if you bend your ankle so that you're standing on your lateral malleolus right here, we call that inversion. That's a relatively easy motion to do. It's going to stretch out some tendons and ligaments in your ankle. We call that a sprained ankle. But there's not a lot of strength in the ankle, so a lot of people invert their ankle by accident when they're horsing around or doing other kinds of activities. Okay, that will produce a sprained ankle. Eversion, on the other hand, is when you try to stand on your medial malleolus. That's really difficult to do because you have many more tendons and ligaments that prevent that kind of motion. So eversion is difficult to do, but if for whatever reason you do evert a foot through some kind of improper activity, that produces even more damage to the ankle joint than a simple inversion injury. But even an inversion injury can be pretty traumatic. Okay, invert when you stand on the lateral malleolus, eversion when you stand on the medial malleolus. Okay, a couple other motions. Let's think of the wrist, then we'll look at that picture. So at the wrist, what am I doing right now? I'm flexing, and then I am extending, and then I am hyperextending. Yeah, it's easy to do. Okay, so there's your wrist. Your ankle, because your lower appendage is kind of twisted around a little bit, it's not just a simple flexion and extension and hyperextension. All right, so let's think of my hand right here as being my foot. And if I push my toes into the ground like this, okay, when I push my toes into the ground, okay, that kind of lifts me up a little bit, right? I just got a little bit taller because my toes now have pushed into the ground. We call that plantar flexion. I'm planting my toes into the ground. That's plantar flexion. Okay, and then when I lift my toes up off the ground like that, we call that dorsiflexion. So right now I'm just standing on my heels with my toes up in the air. I almost fell over, but not quite. Okay, so plantar flexion is pointing your toes into the ground. Dorsiflexion, lifting your toes up. So these are, again, antagonistic motions. Muscles in the posterior leg cause plantar flexions. Muscles in the anterior leg cause dorsiflexion. And because you have nice antagonistic control, we can walk in a pretty nice coordinated fashion. Okay, but for instance, if somebody has a problem with walking, they might not be able to dorsiflect. All right, so if somebody has, and this is particularly important, like for instance, if it was your grandma or grandpa. And in medicine, it used to be for doctors pretty easy to make a diagnosis because they'd be sitting in the office and the patient would actually walk into the office and greet the physician, and by the time the patient sat down, most times the physician had made a diagnosis of what was wrong with the patient already. Okay, just by walking in, reaching out, shaking hands, speaking, things like that. Okay, but nowadays what happens? A doctor might have like three or four different rooms with three or four different patients, and the doctor has 10 minutes with each patient, so guess what the doctor is doing? Running from one room to the next, to the next, to the next, and never really sees the patient move, okay? But there still is kind of an interesting clue. A physician still might look at the tips of a patient's shoes, especially the soles of the shoes, to look and see if they're able to lift their toes up off the ground when they're walking. What's that motion, lifting the toes up off the ground? Dorsiflexion, right? If somebody can't dorsiflex and they're dragging the tips of their shoes on the ground, what happens to them? Well, they wear out, they get all scuffed up, okay? And that's particularly dangerous because if somebody's not lifting their toes up off the ground or they're not dorsiflexing when they're walking, what can happen to them? Yeah, they can trip on a trip hazard, like a crack in a sidewalk or something. And for somebody our age, that's not such a big deal. We'll catch ourselves before we fall. But if it's your grandma or grandpa, chances are they're going to actually fall down. They could break a wrist or they could break a hip. okay, a femur or an ascoxae or something like that. And when you get up into your 80s and 90s, when you have that kind of fracture, then you usually have to go to a convalescence home in order to get those bones healing back once again. You're away from your familiar surroundings and your family, and a lot of people just give up the will to live when that happens. Okay, so just making a really simple diagnosis right here can even like save somebody's life, because that's an indication of a spinal cord injury where there's a nerve leaving somebody's back that's damaged, and that prevents them from dorsiflexing, makes them more prone for tripping. So that's a nice way to diagnose back problems. So I do want you to know all of these particular motions. It's really important. All right, so we got gliding, we've got angular motion, supination, pronation, dorsiflexion, plantar, inversion, eversion, protraction, retraction, elevation, depression, opposition. Right, yeah, we talked about all those things. I don't know if I have another picture here or not. No. All right, so those are all important motions. We're going to go back to the knee in just a second. Okay. What do we call it when we move a body part away from midline? Abduction. Okay. And when we bring it back down, that is abduction. When we move a body part forward, we call that protraction. When we move a body part backwards, that's retraction. Okay. And then if it's just a nice angular motion, you have flexion and extension. Okay, of all those motions, what can you do with a knee? Okay, if this is your knee joint right here, okay, you can flex and extend at the knee, right? You can flex and extend at the knee. Now, what about abduction? Can you do this at the knee? Oh, God, no, right? That's going to break something really bad, okay? Or adduct or abduct at the knee. That's not allowed. All right, so there are ligaments that normally prevent that kind of motion. What about protraction? No, that shouldn't happen. What about retraction? That shouldn't happen either. Now, it does, because the knee is sort of stable, but there's a lot of motion with the knee, got a lot of weight on the knee. So it happens to athletes all the time that they have abduction injuries or protraction retraction injuries, okay, or rotation injuries. And that damages the ligaments and the menisci of the knee. So let's take a look at, I'm going to flip back a couple slides once again and take a look at this knee once again. Sorry about that. Let me know if I fall asleep and I pass by. Ah, here's pretty good. Okay. So we saw that the ligaments deep inside the knee that go from the intercondylar notch within the femur to the intercondylar eminence in the tibia, these ligaments cross over each other. So these are what we call the cruciate ligaments. Here's the anterior cruciate ligament. Here's the posterior cruciate ligament. So normally, this posterior cruciate ligament, remember that's dense regular connective tissue, that's really tough, it prevents the protraction of the knee. But if somebody's playing protraction, right, of the leg. But if somebody's playing football and you get tackled really hard from behind while your femur is held stationary, then this tibia is going to move anteriorly. That's going to damage the anterior cruciate ligament or the ACL. If you're hit from the front and your tibia gets pushed back behind the femur right here, that's going to damage the posterior cruciate ligament. Right, so these cruciate ligaments prevent protraction and retraction in the normal knee. What were some other ligaments that we looked at? Besides the cruciate, what are some others? It comes in a pair. The collateral ligaments. These ligaments right here prevent abduction and adduction at the knee. But if you get really hit hard from the side, right, the medial collateral ligament is not going to get damaged, but the lateral collateral ligament is going to rip or pull off the fibula right here, and that would be a tear of the lateral collateral ligament. Or if you're hit from the medial side of your leg, right, then the tibial collateral or medial collateral ligament is damaged. So that's what these ligaments do. The collateral ligaments prevent abduction and adduction in the normal knee. The cruciate ligaments prevent protraction and retraction within the knee, so that the knee basically acts as what? Just a nice hinge joint. Okay, as well as the shape of the joints right here. Also promote that kind of motion. Okay. So I would like you to know what the function of those ligaments are, the cruciate ligaments compared to the collateral ligaments. Okay, we got to go back to right here. Okay, so something that stabilizes a joint is the shape of the joint itself. And between the carpals, okay, and metacarpals, these are just gliding joints because they're flat. There's no axial motion. There's no rotation within the wrist. These joints can just slide back and forth. They're diarthroses because there's a synovial joint right in here, and you should know all the components of a synovial joint. Make a list of that. Here is a uniaxial motion of a hinge joint, like between the trochlea on the humerus and what's this on the ulna here? Anybody remember? Oh, not everybody had labia. We talked about it last time, so unless you studied over the weekend, probably have forgotten. That's the trochlear notch within the ulna fitting onto the trochlea, and that just allows for flexion and extension at the elbow joint. All right, so the elbow is a nice example of a simple hinge joint when we talk about flexion and extension by itself, not supination and pronation. All right, but when you supinate and pronate, remember the ulna and radius cross over each other, so the head of the radius has to articulate within the radial notch in the ulna. Right, so that's what we call a pivot joint because there's just a rotation when the radius crosses over the ulna and back for pronation and supination. That's a nice pivot joint. Another nice pivot joint would be between C1 and C2, right? Along around the dens or the odontoid process. Right? That just is a single uniaxial motion. There are some biaxial motions with a little bit more complicated joint, like a condyloid joint between the metacarpals and phalanges. Right, so those joints, of course, you can flex and extend, but what else can you do with those? You can abduct and adduct. Okay, so there are two forms of motion between the carpal and phalanx joint right here. Right, so you can flex and extend as well as abduct and adduct. Helpful for playing the piano. So that's a biaxial motion. Okay, there's another joint, the first carpal-metacarpal joint. So here is the trapezium, here is number one metacarpal. In lab you're going to see how you name all these different bones. So these are carpals, here are metacarpals, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Number one starting with the thumb. This is a saddle joint, which allows for adduction and abduction, flexion and extension as well, which then allows for opposition if you can do all those kinds of motions together at the same time. All right, so that's a nice saddle joint. And then we have a couple joints in our body that are ball and socket joints, like the shoulder and the hip joint. So the proximal epiphysis of the humerus or the femur is a ball, and the socket would either be the glenoid cavity, right? But in the hip, what would the glenoid cavity be called? That would be the acetabulum. Okay, and in this kind of joint, what can you do? You can do all kinds of stuff. You can rotate, right? You can rotate the humerus. You can, and here's a strange one to appreciate. What's this motion called? That's flexion, because remember the hip. This is flexion, here is extension. Here's hyperextend. So you can flex at the shoulder and the hip. You can hyperextend, right? You can rotate. And what else can you do? You can abduct and adduct, all because it's a ball and socket joint. And if you do all those motions together, what do you call that thing? That's circumduction, right? So if you abduct, flex, and extend, and rotate all at the same time, that's what we call circumduction. And that's what you can do with a ball and socket joint that you can't do with any other kind of joint. All right, so the sign-in sheet is going around. The joint that I really emphasize in lab and in lecture is the knee, not so much the shoulder. So the glenohumeral joint or shoulder joint, if you want to learn something special about that, then we just probably have to get together in lab and look at that. All right, but I want you to know everything that we talked about in terms of the knee. Any questions at all? Okay. So this lecture was more like physiology than anatomy, because you have to know different motions of joints, what kind of shapes produce, allow a certain kind of motion. So it might be the hardest chapter so far, because it's more like physiology.